Okay, so let me start by thanking Victor and the other organizers for letting me speak today. I'm going to be talking about topology and statistics in superconductors and their relations to non-abelian matter and topological quantum computation. And let me just mention in the beginning, anytime I'll mention superconductor, I'll also mean superconductor, superfluid, and superconductor. So this work has been done with Das Sarma at University of Maryland, Chetan, who is over here, and Dang Hai Li in UC Berkeley. So let me start by giving out the references. I'm going to be talking mostly about the first four papers that we wrote in the last year. There's a new one coming up, the fifth paper, but this is still under preparation. And the fifth one and the last one, part of the research was included in the search and discovery section of Physics Today in 2006. So I'll talk about that too. This is the overview. I'll first give motivation and background of what I'm going to be talking about. Then I'll talk about, in qualitative terms, three important concepts: non-locality, degeneracy, and non-abelian statistics. Then I'll come to the main part of the talk, vortices in 2D P-wave superconductors and the associated Majorana fermions. Then I'll come to talk about those three concepts, non-locality, degeneracy, and non-abelian statistics, this time in more quantitative terms. And finally, I'll end with applications and experiments. So apart from fundamental condensed matter interest, part of the motivation for this research is topological quantum computation. So even though this is not a quantum computation talk, I'll give a very brief overview of quantum computation. And I'll do that by just contrasting classical and quantum bits. As all of us here know, classical bits have two states, which can be represented as state 0 and state 1. On the other hand, a quantum bit is described by a quantum state psi, which is a linear superposition of the two states in the classical bit. So the light bulb on and off are the two classical bit states. So if we denote the two classical states as the north and south pole on a sphere, then any point on the surface of the sphere will indicate the quantum state. But as is obvious, for any quantum computation to succeed, the quantum state psi has to maintain its coherence for a finite period of time, but that's extremely hard. All of us here know that, and that's because the environment decoheres the quantum state very quickly. So, so let me just mention, part of the talk will be elementary or at an introductory level, but hopefully not everything will be elementary to everybody. So at the end of the talk, I'll hope to be giving a flavor of topological quantum computation and the physics behind it. So we're talking about environmental decoherence. Now, that's simply illustrated by taking the simple double well potential of ordinary quantum mechanics. We know if you put a particle in the left well, in the true ground state, the particle in the true quantum ground state, the particle oscillates between the left and the right wells. However, this is not what is seen in laboratory, because very quickly, the particle relaxes to its classical state, which is just localized in only one of the wells. Okay? And the way that happens is the particle interacts with the environment, which can be anything, photons, phonons, even cosmic ray, and that introduces decoherence, and the particle relaxes to become classical. Now, this is the biggest challenge to quantum computation, to somehow get rid of this environmental decoherence. Now, this is where ordinary classical quantum computation says that one can, in principle, one can take care of the environmental decoherence at the level of software by having error correction. But even that is extremely hard. That's people are day by day realizing that even that is extremely hard. And this is where topological quantum computation comes in. TQC says that maybe we can take care of the decoherence at the level of hardware itself. Okay? So how do we do that? So TQC proposes that we may want to look for a quantum state which is sensitive only to the topology of a system and not to local degrees of freedom. Okay? So the idea is topology, which is a global property of a system. The idea is environment, which normally acts through local degrees of freedom. A photon comes and disturbs the system locally. So the idea is if the environment acts through local degrees of freedom, then the environment probably cannot get or cannot change the overall topology of the system. So if you can find a quantum state which is manipulable or changeable only by changing topology and nothing else, and if you use that quantum state as our quantum bits, then the corresponding quantum computation will be free from decoherence even at the level of hardware. Okay, so that's the idea of topological quantum computation. Before we discuss that, let's just take a look at topology and understand why it is a global property. Many of you here have seen this picture, so this very easily, very, very simply illustrates why topology is a global property. So let's take a look at a coffee mug and a donut. Okay, structurally they are very different. They look completely different. However, if you look closely, you'll see there is just one hole in the coffee cup. Okay, the hole through the handle. There is no hole here. This part is the one that holds the coffee. And also, there is just one hole in the donut. The hole through the center. Okay, so one can locally deform the coffee cup to make it look like a structure like this, still with one hole, and then finally go on deforming to make it look like a donut. Okay, so even though locally the two structures are very different, the property which describes how many holes, which is the topology, is identical. Okay, so the idea is environment might change the coffee cup to a donut, but it cannot change the overall topology of the system. So we end up with the task of looking for a many-body quantum state which does not care about local structures or local degrees of freedom, but only cares about such questions as how many holes, etc., the basic topology. Now it turns out there are two condensed matter systems which probably, at least in principle, respects that property, that they are manipulable only by changing the topology. And it turns out the first one is the one made up by quasiparticles in nu equal to 5 half fractional quantum Hall system. And there's a second system which also has that property, and that system consists of quasiparticles in the vortex state of 2D P-wave superconductor. Okay. Now, as far as the topological properties are concerned, the physics of both these systems are identical. So if you understand the physics of the quasiparticles in the vortex state of a P-wave superconductor, we have understood the essential physics of the quasiparticles in the nu equal to 5 half state. So before we discuss in depth the quasiparticles in the vortex state, let's talk about in qualitative terms the three important concepts that I mentioned before. The first one is that of non-locality. Okay, so let's suppose we have a 2D plane, just a 2D substrate, okay, shown here in green. Now, I have not specified what that system is, but for the moment, it's just a two-dimensional system. And let's also suppose that we have two spatially localized objects on the 2D plane. Okay. Now, again, I'm not specifying what the red objects are, but later in the talk, I'll talk about them in terms of quasi-particles in this 2D system. But for the moment, they're just two spatially localized objects. Now, if you look closely, you'll see there are two black dots at the center of these red objects. Now, these two black dots are very unusual kinds of quantum states. Okay? So we have a 2D plane, a two-dimensional system. We have two spatially localized objects, and we have very unusual quantum states, two of them, at the centers of these two objects. Okay? So that's all we have. Now imagine we inject an electron to the system. Okay? The electron, being a quantum particle, has to go to a quantum state. Now suppose these are the only two quantum states available, the two black dots. Okay? Now it turns out these black dots are so unusual kinds of quantum states that the electron cannot simply just go and occupy this quantum state or that quantum state. Okay? There is no way the electron can just go here or there. Okay? But the electron has to go somewhere, okay, to some quantum state. And it turns out the only state the electron can go to is a state which is shared by both of these quantum states. Okay? Now, in principle, these state objects can be far, far away. They can be spatially far apart from each other. Even then, if you inject the electron somehow has to be shared by both of these two state objects. Okay? So there's an intrinsic non-locality in the system. So it takes a pair of quantum states to accommodate an electron. So that's the non-locality that I'll talk about before. Now it turns out this is what actually happens if the 2D system is a P-wave superconductor and these red objects are vortices in the P-wave superconductor. Okay, now let's just talk briefly about statistics. Statistics in the physical context gives the effect on a many particle wave function under exchange of identical particles. So if you have two identical particles and exchange their positions, okay, statistics tells us what happens to the wave function of these two particles. Now naively we expect exchanging twice should be identity. Okay? That's because exchanging twice, we just bring the two particles to their original positions. And this is indeed what happens for bosons. For exchanging R1 and R2, we get the same wave function back. And for fermions, on the other hand, by exchanging 1 and 2, we get the same wave function with the minus sign, so that when you exchange back, we get the same wave function. And indeed, these are the only two kinds of particles which you see in three dimensions. It turns out, in 2 plus 1 dimension, however, two exchanges might not be equal to identity. Okay? Now, the reason that is so is that if you imagine two particles on a two-dimensional plane, two identical particles, and let's say you take one particle, okay, move it around the other particle, so you take particle number 1, move it around particle number 2, and then you exchange it back, so move it around to its original position, then in that process, you effectively made particle 1 go in a loop around the other particle, all in the two-dimensional plane. Now, the state of the system now is topologically different from when the particle 1 did not make a loop, and that is because you cannot shrink this closed loop to a point without going through particle number 2, the particle at the center. Okay? So that's the reason why in 2D, the two cases are topologically different. Contrast this with 3D, where if you take another particle, move one particle around another in a closed loop, and you can locally deform the loop to a situation where the particles did not cross. Okay? So locally, in 3D, if you do two exchanges, that gives rise to identity operation. In 2 plus 1D, however, that may not be the case. So here are the rules of statistics. Bosons, as I said before, the wave function does not change. For fermions, the wave function gets a minus sign. But as I said, in 2D, two exchanges may not be equal to identity, so even the single exchange may be non-trivial. So if you exchange 1 and 2, we get the wave function with a phase factor, e to the power I theta. And indeed, this is what we see in the nu equal to 1/3 Laughlin state. But there's a fourth possibility in 2D. Okay, now this is important. This is what I'm going to be talking about for most of the talk, for all of the talk. So there's a fourth possibility in 2D, okay, which is non-abelian statistics. So suppose you have in a two-dimensional surface, your ground state is degenerate. So you have many different states all in the ground state itself. So there's a degenerate manifold of ground states. So these states are denoted by an index, so these are psi I, psi j, psi k, etc. Now by exchanging 1 and 2, you might not go to a same wave function just with the phase factor, but in the process you might actually change the whole wave function itself. You can go from one state in this ground state manifold to a completely different state in the same ground state manifold, and the only constraint that comes from physics is that the corresponding matrix operator has to be unitary. Okay?
So, what is the third spatial coordinate, R I?
Oh, those are just other particle coordinates. Yes. So as I was saying, if you have a degenerate manifold of ground states, then in 2D, there's a fourth possibility that if you exchange particle 1 and 2, then you can go from one state in this degenerate manifold to another completely different state in the same degenerate manifold. And this transformation, of course, is given by matrix transformation because you have more than one state here. But then here, the transformation is given by matrix. Now, matrices can be non-abelian. So this is what is called non-abelian statistics. Okay, in other words, for all of these transformations, if you exchange 1 and 2 and you exchange 2 and 3, it does not matter in which order you do them, as long as you do the same exchanges. But over here, since there are matrices involved, matrix products of matrices may not commute, so the statistics, at least in principle, can be non-abelian in 2D. So this is my pictorial representation of non-abelian statistics. So again, so we are back to our 2D plane, which is our 2D system, which is a PUF superconductor. We have the vortices, okay, and we have those very unusual quantum states, those black dots at the centers of the vortices. And we know that these quantum states are they have the intrinsic non-locality, which is manifested by, if you inject an electron, then the quasi-particle of the superconductor is shared by the two vortices, even if they are far apart. So suppose these two vortices are paired in that sense, and those two vortices are paired in that sense. Now, it turns out for this kind of a system, there is a degenerate manifold of ground states. I'll talk about where that degeneracy comes from later. So for the moment, just take it from me that there's a degenerate manifold of ground states. Now, it turns out, so there's a degenerate manifold of ground states. Now, it turns out, if you take one vortex from one pair, move it around in a closed circle, in a closed cycle, by around another vortex from a different pair. Now, that's important. It has to be around a vortex from a different pair. If you do that, okay, that gives rise to a transformation. Here I have shown it for just one exchange, but this closed loop is for two exchanges. But in this case, the exchanges give rise to a transformation where one state from this degenerate manifold goes to a completely different state, and the two states are connected by a unitary matrix. Okay? So let's recollect what we have so far. We have a system which is very non-local, which is intrinsically non-local. Okay? Now, the non-locality already tells you that the system, in some sense, is protected from the environment, because these vortices or these quantum states can be far away from each other, okay? But the excitations will have to be completely non-local, okay? So if the environment, you know, disturbs the system close to one of the vortices, that doesn't do anything to the excitations, okay? So it is already, in some sense, removed or protected from the environment. Moreover, we have non-abelian statistics, which says the only way one can change from one state in the manifold, psi k, to another state in the manifold, psi j, is by taking one vortex or one of these objects, moving it around in a closed loop. Now again, these particles, these vortices, can be far away from each other. So this is a really large transformation, taking one vortex, moving it around in a closed loop. So in this system, the states, psi k's, are only manipulable by changing the topology of these braids. These are what are called braids. Okay, these are the braid transformations. So the state of the system is only sensitive to the braid topologies. Okay? So here we have found a many particle quantum state which is manipulable only by topology of these braids. And you hope that the environment cannot change the topology of the braids. Okay, now all of this interesting physics turns out happens in two-dimensional P-wave superconductor. Now a P-wave superconductor can have various different kinds of order parameters. The particular P-wave superconductor that I'll be focusing on is what is called a PX plus IPY superconductor. Okay, so let's talk about 2D PX plus IPY superconductor. So first, let's consider spinless or spin polarized system. Okay, so all the electrons in this system have the same spin. Okay, so spin is not an important quantum number anymore. So we'll just ignore the spin for the following discussion. So for Px plus Ipy superconductor, this is a superconductor, so the order parameter delta is a function of P, where P is momentum, is simply an amplitude delta naught times the factor Px plus Ipy. Okay, so that's as simple as that. Okay? Now you can write Px plus Ipy as mod P times e to the power I theta P, where theta P is the angle in momentum space. Okay? Now you can get a feel of this order parameter by contrasting this with the more familiar dx square minus y square order parameter in cuprates, where this factor is replaced by px square minus py square. So here we have px plus ipy, and because of this factor of I, the system breaks time reversal symmetry. Okay? We can get, you know, more, we can take a look at the order parameter in momentum space again on the Fermi surface, and because of this factor e to the power I theta p, the order parameter is 1 here on the Fermi surface, that this e to the power I theta p is 1 on the Fermi surface on the x-axis. On the y-axis it's I, on the minus x-axis is minus I, and on the minus y-axis is minus I. Again, because of these factors of I, the system breaks time reversal symmetry. Okay, what do I mean by that? If you apply the time reversal operator T on Px plus Ipy, Px goes to minus Px, Py goes to minus Py, but also because of time reversal operation, I goes to minus I. Okay? So the order parameter goes from Px plus Ipy to Px minus Ipy, so the system breaks time reversal symmetry. Now, before you think this is just a theorist's construct of an order parameter, let me mention that this order parameter has indeed been found, or it has indeed been confirmed in experiments in strontium-ruthenite. This is indeed the kind of order parameter. In a superconducting state of strontium-ruthenite, the system does break time reversal symmetry, and the corresponding order parameter is indeed Px plus Ipy. This is from a recent Physics Today issue where the article claimed the superconductor breaking time reversal symmetry has indeed been found, and that material is the strontium-ruthenite. Now this is the lattice structure of strontium-ruthenite. Okay? Those of you who are familiar with the cuprate lattice structure, it's the exact exactly the same lattice structure of strontium-ruthenite. So it looks very three-dimensional. However, it turns out the system is really quasi-two-dimensional. And that's because all of the important physics happens in two-dimensional ruthenium-oxygen planes. Okay, so the green circles here are oxygen. These red circles here are ruthenium atoms. Okay, all of the important physics happens in these ruthenium-oxygen planes. There's one here, there's one there. And strontium just sits in the middle and it doesn't do much. Okay, this is exactly similar to what happens for lanthanum barium copper oxide, which is a familiar high-TC cuprate superconductor, where these planes are copper oxygen planes and the lanthanum barium do not do much. So again, so this is a quasi-two-dimensional Px plus Ipy superconductor. However, this is not spinless though, and that's going to be important later. So this is confirmation of Px plus Ipy pairing. Okay? Now, as I said, Px plus Ipy means the system breaks time reversal symmetry. And it turns out, if you shine circularly polarized light into something, into a system which breaks time reversal symmetry, then the phase of circular polarization shifts because of the time reversal symmetry breaking. Okay? So that's a test of time reversal breaking in a system. This is called, the shift in the circular polarization is called K effect or K angle, delta theta K. Okay? This is an experiment which is done by Aaron Kapchanik's group in Stanford. Okay? This is a different experiment, Josephson Junction experiment, which was done by Van Hollingen's group in UIUC. Okay, let's just talk about this experiment for the moment. So it turns out strontium-ruthenite has a TC of about 1.5 Kelvin. So here, the y-axis is the change in the phase of circular polarization, the K angle, the x-axis is temperature. Now recall I said the system can be in two different domains. It can be in Px plus Ipy or Px minus Ipy. Okay? However, you can actually align the domains to get a finite effect, and that you do by applying a magnetic field. And it turns out if you lower the temperature, there's no K angle, there's no K effect. However, just below TC, the K angle peaks up, so it clearly shows that the system breaks time reversal symmetry. This is for the other direction of the magnetic field, for the other alignment of the domains. So this clearly demonstrates the system breaks time reversal symmetry. This is further confirmation that the order parameter is really Px plus Ipy.
Wait, it's in an applied magnetic field. How do they...
It's a very small applied magnetic field which aligns all the domains. That's what you need to do to... that's what you always need to do to test spontaneously broken symmetry. Okay, so with that introduction to Px plus Ipy order parameter, let's come back to theory again. Okay, so now let's consider again our 2D P plus Ip superconductor shown here in green, and now imagine we apply a magnetic field. Okay, and the magnetic field, as you know, cannot pass through a superconductor. However, in type 2 superconductor, the magnetic field can still pass through in spatially localized regions. These are the vortices in the PUF superconductor, and the red lines are the field lines. So these are the vortices which are defined by the order parameter phase rotating by 2 pi n, where n is an integer around the core. And also the order parameter amplitude is suppressed at the core. Okay? So the vortex cores are normal, okay? Are close to normal. Okay? Now we have effectively normal potential wells in the otherwise bulk superconductor. Okay? Now go back to ordinary quantum mechanics. You have a potential well. The potential well will trap bound state energies. Okay? Exactly same thing happens here. You have normal potential wells, so you trap low energy normal bound states in the vortex cores. Okay? Now the reason I'm discussing this because one of these bound states, one of these discrete bound states is going to be those unusual quantum states, those black dots. This is the bound state spectrum. Okay, you can solve the bound state spectrum in the vortex core. It turns out, if you solve it for S wave superconductor, the bound state spectrum En is given by n plus half times omega naught, where omega naught is a scale given by the superconducting order parameter in the bulk divided by Fermi energy. Notice the lowest state in the vortex core for S wave superconductor is at a finite energy. Okay. However, if you do that for Px plus Ipy superconductor, the bound state spectrum is given by simply n times omega naught, where n is an integer. So the lowest energy state in the vortex core is exactly at zero energy. Okay? Everything else is separated by a gap given by omega naught. So if you inject your electron or something else at an energy below omega naught, it's only these zero energy states that you are probing. Okay, now this n equal to zero energy states are those unusual quantum states, those black dots.
Some question.
Sure.
So, cold atoms, if you have the DCFD super solar, where you have the potential that you may arbitrarily small or even negative, does this formula still hold when chemical potential is very small or it breaks out? Or am I not?
That I wouldn't be able to say, wouldn't be able to tell you.
This is only in the BCS?
This is only in the BCS. Yes, this is only in the BCS regime. And obviously in the other regime where it goes to BEC, this does not hold. This is just for the BCS.
What is also of interest is what happens when chemical potential is small.
Exactly. So that's the part that I wouldn't be able to tell you. But maybe you have, do you know? I mean, you have...
Actually, I don't.
Okay.
Although I suspect that there are people who calculate it.
I think. Okay.
Even within BCS, if chemical potential is too small, I think there is a transition from the strong pairing to weak pairing.
Yeah, that's the one that we are discussing.
Okay.
Okay, so how do you see that this bound state spectrum is like that? Let me just briefly, just one slide, give you how we see that. So you have these vortex cores, which are like normal potential wells in the otherwise bulk superconductor. So you do what you do in ordinary quantum mechanics. You solve the Schrodinger equation in the potential well. You solve the Schrodinger equation for the wave function inside the well, outside the well, match the solution at the boundary of the potential well, match the derivatives at the boundary of the potential well. This is just slightly more complicated here because you have a superconductor in the substance as opposed to vacuum. So the superconductor has a Hamiltonian, but otherwise the Bogle-Bob-Degen equation is exactly like the Schrodinger equation, so that's like the analog of Schrodinger equation. And for ease of calculation, you assume the order parameter is identically zero in the vortex core, and it's finite outside, so you assume a step function profile for the order parameter. and you solve for this Bogle-Bob-Degen equation, it turns out you get a consistent solution for Dagen value equal to zero. Okay? So that confirms there is a zero energy state inside the vortex core. But however, in order to solve the Bogle-Bob-Degen, we made various approximations. So the idea is there a theorem that guarantees that you'll have a zero energy state as long as you have a vortex in a PUF superconductor? It turns out we recently proved such a theorem, which is analogous to the index theorem, which was discussed before in the context of one-dimensional system. So the idea is we look for a different system where there is a zero energy state, which is experimentally verified, theoretically very well established. It turns out if you take one-dimensional Dirac theory for electrons, okay, then you have such a theorem. In 1976, Jakiv and Rebbe prove that if you have 1D Dirac field theory, there is always a zero energy state if there is a mass domain wall in the Dirac field theory. I'll explain in a moment what that means. Okay? So this is a theorem which is called an index theorem for a reason that does not concern us. But the theorem says there is always a zero energy state if there is a mass domain wall in 1D Dirac field theory.
In 81, Weinberg proved it for two dimensions, which I think is what you would like to have in your case.
Yeah, but I'm not going to be proving the theorem in two dimension. I'll map up my two-dimensional problem onto an effective one-dimensional problem. But I'm not aware of that theorem in two dimensions, so maybe you can tell me later.
I will talk about it tomorrow.
Oh, I see. Okay. Okay, that's even better. Okay, so you have, yeah, exactly. So that's the Artios Singer theorem. Yes, this is the analog of that theorem in 1D. But, you know, the two-dimensional Artios Singer theorem does not directly apply to my case. So I have to map it onto one-dimensional problem.
Well, I think the index theorem and topology is a very general theorem.
Yeah.
I'm talking specifically for the case of a Fermi field coupled to a scalar field, which is your order parameter, what you want.
Okay.
If I'm getting it right.
Okay, but we'll talk about it later. Okay. So let me briefly tell you what the theorem in 1D is. So we have one-dimensional Dirac theory for electrons, okay? Let's not get into the too much details of one-dimensional Dirac theory, but let's just look at the two terms. This is a free Dirac theory, okay? So we have a kinetic energy term, which normally comes with a del x operator, which is the case here, and there's a mass term, okay? So there's a mass which depends on x, where x is the one-dimensional coordinate, okay? Now, you will see there's a sigma z coming with del x, and there's a sigma x coming with mx. Now you know, in Dirac field theory, the electron operator psi is a column vector, is normally a four-dimensional column vector, but this is a spinless system, so the electron operator psi is a two-dimensional column vector. So sigma z and sigma x act on these two-dimensional column vectors, which are psi's. Okay? So you know, let's forget about psi and everything else. Let's just look at the mass term. Okay? Now, the mass term could be constant, or it could be trivially dependent on x, or it can be spatially odd, okay? Now, there are two distinct situations where the mass term is trivially dependent on x, or the mass term is odd, okay? So let's look at the situation where the mass term is spatially odd. So the theorem says any time you have a Hamiltonian which looks like this, where the sigma z comes with del x and sigma x come with mx, okay? Anytime you have a Hamiltonian which looks like this, and then the mass is spatially odd, there is always a zero energy solution of this Hamiltonian. There is always an eigenstate with eigenvalue exactly zero, and the eigenstate is localized at the point where the mass changes sign. Okay, so that's the theorem. So there's a zero energy state which is located on the mass domain wall. These mass domain walls are topological excitations in this 1D Dirac theory. Now this is the theory which describes the low energy physics of polyacetylene. Okay? Now this existence of this zero energy state is very well confirmed by experiments in polyacetylene. This is a very brief overview of the story of polyacetylene. Polyacetylene is a carbon-hydrogen compound. Okay, so it's just CH. Now, carbon being tetravalent has to have four bonds. It makes one bond with one of the neighboring carbon atoms. It makes another bond with the hydrogen atom. And since it is tetravalent, it has to make a double bond with the other neighboring carbon atom. Okay, so that's the structure. This is a one-dimensional structure. Polyacetylene is a one-dimensional system. However, if you look, if you are a little more careful, you can see this double bond can be either in this direction or it can be on the other direction. It doesn't cost any energy. It doesn't make any difference. So the ground state of the system is doubly degenerate. Okay? Now, if you have a chain of polyacetylene, which is exactly that, the low energy theory for that is going to be given by one-dimensional Dirac problem with the mass trivially dependent on x or being a constant. However, if you have a chain of polyacetylene where the double bond, here the double bonds are the solid bonds. If you have a chain of polyacetylene where the double bonds change direction, so it goes from this direction to that direction, there's a defect here. This is called a domain wall. This is a topological excitation in polyacetylene. And this kind of a chain of polyacetylene is going to be described by 1D Dirac problem where the mass changes sign. Okay, so the mass is really related to the double bond operator. And it turns out this theorem, which came actually before people looked into the physics of polyacetylene, this theorem already guarantees that any time you have a mass domain wall, there's a zero energy state. Okay? And there are very interesting predictions based on the zero energy state, and that's the celebrated Suess-Rieffer-Heger physics of polyacetylene, which is responsible in part for a Nobel Prize for Alan Heger. So let's recapitulate again. We have 1D Dirac theory of a mass domain wall that guarantees there's a zero energy state. So we are going to be interested in seeing whether my 2D P plus IP superconductor problem with the vortex can be mappable to a Hamiltonian that looks like this with a spatially changing mass, with a spatially odd mass. However, this is a one-dimensional system. Ours is a two-dimensional system, so we have to somehow map the 2D problem onto 1D. And the way we do that is what people do in other contexts, which namely in Kondo problem. You take fermion operators in your two-dimensional problem, decompose the fermion operator in various angular momentum channels, you write your Hamiltonian as a sum of Hamiltonians in various angular momentum channels, and see if you're fortunate, you'll get an effective one-dimensional theory where only one of the angular momentum channel is decoupled from the rest. And that's the channel that will illustrate the zero-energy state. So you do that. I'm going to explain in a second what I meant by the previous two or three sentences. So we take our 2D P wave superconductor. Okay, we have a kinetic energy of a potential energy. Kinetic energy is simple. There is no spin here. The potential energy is just the BCS pairing potential energy. So the order parameter comes here with a Kx plus Iky. Okay, and in order to map it into an effective one-dimensional problem, we do what I mentioned before. We take the fermion operator, decompose the fermion operator in various angular momentum channels, so the m's are integers, okay? And that comes with the e to the power I m theta k. So by doing that, I take care of the angle. I'll not give you all the details, I'll just give you the results. If you do that for 2D PUF superconductor with a vortex, okay, then the kinetic energy term is diagonal in the angular momentum index, okay? This just becomes CMQ dagger CMQ. On the other hand, if you do it with the pairing term, okay, the pairing term is more complicated. It turns out each CM, each channel M, is coupled to a channel 2 minus M. Okay? And you can naively look that, you can naively see that's what you expect, is because the Px plus Ipy superconductor has angular momentum 1 because it's Kx plus Iky. The vortex has another angular momentum 1, even though in real space. And that's the reason why M and 2 minus M are coupled. Okay? So you have a sum of Hamiltonians in various angular momentum channels. And they're all coupled, except M equal to 1. Okay? In M equal to 1, this is uncoupled, obviously. And M equal to 1, the pairing term is also uncoupled from the rest. Okay? So in M equal to 1, the Hamiltonian looks exactly an effective one-dimensional problem because the angular integration has already been taken care of. And if you do the Fourier transform of this Hamiltonian, lo and behold, that looks exactly like the 1D Dirac problem. Okay? And the only difference with 1D Dirac problem is that now the electron operator chi is a NAMBU operator, which is a signature that this came from superconductor, as opposed to an ordinary Dirac problem where the electron operator has two independent components. Okay, so now we have an effective one-dimensional problem in the angular momentum channel 1, and all other channels are coupled with each other. So they are complicated. Let's just ignore it. In angular momentum 1, we have a Hamiltonian that looks exactly like the one Dirac problem, and the corresponding electron operator is just the NAMBU operator. And it turns out if you do the Fourier transform of the mass term, the mass is spatially odd.
Question.
Yes.
So in one-dimensional case, neural net space is topologically protected, meaning if I change the domain more, if I stretch or if I change the potential profile, as far as my potential goes to zero energy, there is a
exactly. Exactly.
Where here, if I change this M, how the bearing potential in two-dimensional system change?
No, yeah, so this is not exactly analogous to the pairing potential changing sign, because the pairing potential is going from finite to zero. But, you know, so this A, factor A, is not just the pairing potential. But you can actually see that this A has to be spatially odd, simply because this A is with C1, C dagger, and C dagger. So these are two fermions, okay? So if you interchange between Q and Q prime, okay, in order for this term to be even non-zero, this A has to be odd in Q minus Q prime.
But how about if I change, so I think you are assuming the circular vortex, but if I change the profile potential a little bit?
No, that doesn't do anything. That's the whole point.
Okay.
That's the whole point. That will change in principle the Bogle-Bob-Dijon equation, the
right.
Solutions. Here that doesn't do anything.
Okay.
As long as you just have a quantized circulation of the phase by one, that's important. If it is by two, you can actually show by same sort of thing that you don't have a one dimension. As long as it's one or three or five, you get a mass term which has to be odd in Q minus Q prime, and in real space it's especially odd mass term.
But I think you have to add that it is very important to have one isolated vortex.
No, this is exactly, that's exactly.
If you have a vortex nearby, then it's no longer true. Zero moments will disappear. Actually, I sent you this email, but I should make this comment because otherwise some people who might see this on the web might get a little bit upset. The thing is that usually in the theorem, the first property, which is topologically protected, you change your operator in any way and the number of zero moles doesn't change. And this is true for Dirac fermions, but this is generally not true for this kind of NAMBU fermions, for whom zero moles are Majorana fermions as opposed to Dirac. And in fact, it's possible to show that generally, you know, if you have some order parameter with a number of vortices, you won't have any topologically protected moles. And apparently that was understood by Nick Reed 7 years ago, and he wrote his paper by Reed and Green, but he never commented on it, and so it created some confusion. And so in the end, Lever, Zipolsky, and I wrote a paper where we put an argument for why this is so in the paper, although we felt a little bit awkward because we thought that this argument was known in the community, just never appeared in print. So if you have a bunch of vortices and you bring them close together, the zero moles will split and they will no longer be a zero. They're not protected topologically. They're only, in a way, protected geometrically. So if you do have just one single vortex very far away from the boundary of the system, that's another important requirement, then yes, it is true that you will have zero moles and they will be the
rule
we were describing.
Yeah.
So a number of people, especially Nick Reed, I think, well, he's not here, so I'm afraid to speak for him, but he'd be upset because mathematically, this is not an Ethereum.
No, but this is no. Okay, that I understand. But you know that point that you are making is really if you have zero modes and if you have two zero modes, then this is a mode at zero energy. This is another mode at zero energy. And if there is a coupling between them, you know gamma one, gamma two, that is going to shift the energies to plus minus e. That's the point that you are making. And if the two vortices are far away, then these shifts are exponentially suppressed in the distance.
Okay.
That's the, I think that's a point that's not overlooked that much.
Well, but if you take the Dirac system...
No, this is true for only one. No. So what this achieves is that it shows that you have a zero energy state if you have an isolated vortex, and that solution does not depend on the particular solution of the Bogoliubov region. It's very robust in the sense that exactly what you mentioned, that the order parameter can have any profile as long as the phase of the order parameter changes by 2 pi. There's one, you know, vorticity is odd, all of these holds, and there's a zero energy mode. Without any, you can perturb the system locally, that doesn't do anything.
Isn't your solution also reliant on the fact that the vortex is symmetric?
No, because, I wrote that, I included that in the email, and I can talk to you about that after the talk. These Qs are really small momenta, and that actually helps us becoming an approximation, because for a very small Q, this is long wavelength problem, so rotational symmetry is guaranteed. You can always do this M, decoupling in angular momentums. Okay, so this says that as long as you have a single odd vorticity vortex in the system, you have a zero mode, irrespective of what local perturbation you have. Okay, so let's recapitulate again. So I have 10 more minutes.
Well, usually, so far, they usually give the speaker as much time as the speaker needs. So they have an hour and a half tops.
Okay.
2 hour tops, although maybe that's a bit too long.
Okay, but I'll probably end in 15 minutes probably. So let's recapitulate what we have achieved. We have a 2D PUF superconductor with a vortex, okay? And we have found that in the angular momentum channel 1, the Hamiltonian looks exactly like the 1D Dirac problem. Okay, but with the only difference is that now the electron operator is a NAMBU type operator. So this and the mass is spatially odd. So this guarantees that there's a zero energy state where the mass changes sign, and that turns out to be the point where there's a vortex. Okay, now if you go ahead and write the second quantized operator for the zero energy state, okay, you can solve for the eigenfunction of the Hamiltonian that gives you the U and V of your solution for the second quantized operator for the zero energy state. And if you do that, that's the solution, the spatially localized solution, this exponentially suppressed factor. And if you do that, then this gamma dagger, which is the second quantized operator, is just a linear combination of C1 and C1 dagger. Okay, so that's the difference. In case of Dirac, this would be F1 dagger or F dagger plus G dagger, two independent fields. Here, these are simply Hermitian conjugate of each other. Okay. That's the only difference from the Dirac problem. And because of that property, when you take gamma dagger and gamma, this dagger just switches position, and you get gamma dagger exactly equal to gamma. Okay. So this gives you at one go a guaranteed zero energy state and the corresponding fermionic state to be Majorana. Okay. So this is called a Majorana fermion as opposed to an ordinary fermion. Because if you go back and recollect your second quantization, you'll see the operators for an ordinary electron, C and C dagger, are not identifiable. In fact, it's their anti-commutation relation that enforces Fermi statistics of electrons. Okay? On the other hand, here, the operators, the creation and the annihilation operators for the zero energy state, it's self-Hermitian. Okay? In other words, an electron cannot go and occupy this zero energy state, because if it did, then the electron would not follow Fermi statistics. Okay? Now this kind of a fermion is called a Majorana fermion after Italian physicist Majorana. So now let's come back and understand the non-locality. Okay, those three concepts that I talked about before. So suppose you have two vortices now, okay, and you have these black dots, the zero energy states, and everything else is at higher energy. So you're looking at the system at an energy less than omega naught. Okay, so you have only these two states which do the important physics. Okay, so you have a gamma 1 corresponding to this black dot, you have a gamma 2 corresponding to that black dot, and using these two equations, you can write down the anti-commutation relation, gamma I, gamma j is just simply 2 delta ij. Okay, this is not a fermionic anti-commutation relation. So a single gamma mode cannot accommodate an electron. Okay? However, you can see you can construct an operator C, which is a linear combination of gamma 1 and gamma 2, with a factor of I in between. So C dagger is not equal to C anymore. And you can actually show that this C and C dagger now do satisfy fermion anti-commutation relation. So in other words, if you inject an electron at an energy less than omega naught, let's say much less than omega naught, then the electron has only these two states. That's the only two, those are the only two states from where any density of states will be seen by the electron. However, since the electron cannot go to here and there, the electron has to go to the state which is a superposition of both. Okay? So even if these two vortices are far away, you know, very far away, the electron somehow has to know about both of them. There's a question of causality here that we are writing a paper about right now. So that's the last paper in my list of references, but I'm not going to be dealing much about causality, because what this says is that if you inject an electron in one vortex, the other vortex immediately knows about it. But we're going to clarify the question of causality. So in any case, so that's the inherent non-locality.
So you mean that there is a finite time to give this?
Exactly. There's a finite time, and also so even that finite time, if it is finite, you can in principle imagine these two vortices to be far, far away. And the omega naught does not depend on their distance. So in principle, you can still break causality. But it turns out you cannot, because by doing this kind of thing, you inject an electron in one vortex, the other vortex gets the amplitude. By doing this kind of thing, you cannot send any information. This is the same as EPR. Okay? Okay, so let's now come back to the second concept that I discussed before, ground state degeneracy. Okay? So we have two vortices, gamma 1 and gamma... So we have two vortices and two zero energy states, gamma 1 and gamma 2. Now notice, gamma 1 and gamma 2 are exactly zero energy states. So the electronic state described by C.C. Dagger is also a state at zero energy, as long as these two vortices are far away from each other. Okay? So this is an exact zero energy electronic state, and this state can be occupied, or can be unoccupied, which we'll call state 0, or occupied, which we'll call state 1, and these two states are exactly degenerate, because this is zero energy state. It doesn't matter if this state is occupied or unoccupied. It doesn't cost any energy to the system. Okay? And you might wonder where these electrons will come from. But remember, this is the substrate is a superconductor. Superconductor does not respect time reversal symmetry. So it can emit electrons in pairs. So the quasi-particles can float around, and the quasi-particles can go and occupy or unoccupy the state described by C and C dagger. And you have two states which are exactly degenerate and extremely non-local. So these are the two states of a qubit. Okay? In topological quantum computation, these are the two states which are proposed to be the quantum bits. So, for the case of two vortices, you have two degenerate states. Now imagine you have 2n vortices. So you have 2n Majorana fermionic states. Okay? So you can pair them up in some arbitrary way, and you can get n electronic modes. Okay? N ordinary electronic modes. Okay? Now they can be occupied or unoccupied. Each of them can be occupied or unoccupied by a superconducting quasi-particle. So we have a 2 to the power n fold degenerate ground states protected by a gap given by omega naught. Okay? So any state which has energy 0, any state in the ground state manifold has to be a linear combination of these 2 to the power n states. That's the macroscopic ground state degeneracy that I mentioned before. This is non-abelian statistics. This was first discussed in this context by Ivanov. Later, these two papers, we and also Victor and Leo, we included this. So these are the three references. So you have Majorana modes. How do we have non-abelian statistics? Before we look into that, let's look at a real space picture of a vortex. Okay, so you have a vortex core, which is shown here in black, and the red solid arrows are the give the phases of the superconducting order parameter. So the order parameter goes from the phase of the order parameter goes from 0 to 90 to 180 to 270 to 0 again. So there's a change of the phase by 2 pi. Okay, now the superconducting order parameter is a bilinear in the A operator. A is the fermionic operators of the system. So the superconducting order parameter changes by 2 pi by circulating the vortex. In other words, if you take a superconducting quasi-particle, which is a linear operator in A and A dagger, and the, if the quasi-particle moves around the vortex, the quasi-particle will change its phase by pi. Okay? So the quasi-particle will pick up a phase pi. In other words, it will have a change of sign. Using that, you can show that if you take two Majorana fermions, which are nothing but superconducting quasi-particles, if you take two Majorana fermions and exchange their positions, then gamma 1 goes to gamma 2, but gamma 2 goes to minus gamma 1. This minus is this factor, this phase pi. Okay? So this is really the crux of non-abelian statistics, this minus sign. Now, what is the operator that gives us this, that will give us this transformation? What is the operator that acts on the Hilbert space of these two Majorana fermions to give us this minus sign? It turns out you can write down an operator, simply 1 plus gamma 2 gamma 1, that gives this transformation. Namely, you operate T on gamma 1, you get gamma 2, and you operate by T on gamma 2, you get a minus gamma 1. Okay, so that's the operator. You can write this operator as exponential, pi by 4 gamma 2 gamma 1. You can easily see by expanding the exponential that this is true. And then using gamma 1 and gamma 2, the relation of them with C, you can write that as 2C dagger C minus 1. Okay? Now this operator, you can write in the basis of the two degenerate states, 0 and C dagger 0. Okay? If you do that, then this part becomes a sigma Z. So you can see that the exchange operator of the two Majorana fermions becomes an exponential minus I sigma Z matrix. Okay, so the exchange operation here is a matrix operation. So far, this is just a diagonal matrix. So there's nothing non-abelian about it. It's just a complicated way of writing the exchange operator. However, if you have more than two vortices, four vortices, you can show that in some cases the exchange operator is an off-diagonal matrix. Okay, so here in the case of two Majorana fermions, you have a 2 to the power 1 fold degeneracy, and you have a 2 to the power 1 cross 2 to the power 1 dimensional matrix as the exchange operator. Similarly, for n to n Majorana fermions, you have a 2 to the power n fold degenerate manifold, and the exchange operations are 2 to the power n cross 2 to the power n dimensional matrices. So this is a brief sketch of application to topological quantum computation. So we have non-local qubit, which is, as I said, is removed from the environment in some sense already. And you have non-abelian statistics, which gives you unitary operators. So you take one vortex and you move it around another vortex. That gives rise to matrix transformation on the quantum state of the system. And you can use those matrix transformation to construct quantum gates. Okay? And these quantum gates, which are built by braiding one vortex around another, at least in principle, are perfect because these are statistical operations. So it doesn't matter if your braid loops are locally deformed. As long as the topologies are same, these braids, these gates are perfect. So this gives rise to noiseless quantum computation, at least in principle. This is an aside. This talks about topological ground state degeneracy. It turns out many of you here know that any topologically ordered state in the ground state has non-trivial degeneracies on multiply connected surfaces. For example, on a torus, there are non-trivial degeneracies. It turns out the ground state degeneracy of abelian or ASF superconductor is 4, but the same degeneracy for a non-abelian PX plus IPY superconductor is 3, and that's because of the presence of these Majorana fermions. But I'll not get into the discussion of that. Let me now briefly talk about the three experiments. I'll just take 3 minutes for the three experiments that we proposed recently. The first one talks about half quantum vortices in strontium-ruthenite. As we saw before, strontium-ruthenite has a quasi-2D structure of ruthenium-oxygen planes, and experiments have confirmed PX plus IPY superconductivity. However, it's a spin-full superconductor. The system is not spinless. Okay? Now, unfortunately, for spin-full PX plus IPY superconductor, ordinary vortices, the ones that you'll see by applying a magnetic field, the vortices with flux quantum 1, the lowest energy vortices with flux quantum 1, those ordinary vortices do not carry Majorana fermions, and that's because it's a spin-full superconductor. However, it turns out you can have more exotic half-quantum vortices where the magnetic flux quantum carried by these vortices is actually half, as opposed to one, and these half quantum vortices do carry Majorana fermions. And it's easy to see why, because half quantum vortices are effectively, you can actually show by writing down equations, are effectively just ordinary vortices with vorticity 1 for only one of the spins, and 0 vortex for the other spins. Okay, that's the effective description of a half quantum vortex. So we are back to an ordinary single quantum vortex in a spin polarized system, okay, yes, for a spinless system.
How
they
create them? Also by magnetic field or something?
Yeah.
So the
purpose is that
if you have
some
magnetic field, you
have... That was the paper, how do you create them. So the idea is if you apply a magnetic field and the magnetic field is small, then the vortices that you create are these ordinary vortices with n equal to 1. Okay, and so they are useless for non-abelian matter. However, it turns out, and then the reason why half quantum vortices are not realized is because there's a spin-orbit coupling in the system. Otherwise, you know, half quantum vortices have flux quantum half, which should be at a smaller energy because the energy of a vortex system depends on n squared.
Okay? How did Leggett and Heap propose to create these half quantum?
Leggett and Heap did not propose to create the half quantum vortices. They showed that these are effectively ordinary vortices in only one of the spin sector. The people who actually propose in the context of helium-3 are Saloma and Volovic, which I should have put in the in this. It's the same situation, the same way we proposed for the Strunz-Shahn Luthenert. So the idea is the half quantum vortices have spin orbit coupling, which is what makes in the context of helium-3, which is what makes it higher energy. So you have to somehow quench the spin orbit coupling, and you can do that by applying a magnetic field. And there's a little bit more detail in terms of the actual structure of the order parameter. So we propose the analog of that for Strunz-Shahn Luthenert. So there, they proposed it for a helium-3 film. You need a helium-3 film to have it. Sorry?
Presumably by rotating
So you have these vortices by rotating a helium-3 film. And but the important thing is you have to have two-dimensional planes for this mechanism to work. Strunz-Shahn Luthenert, on the other hand, already gives two-dimensional superconductivity.
But they also need to see a block laminary field.
In yes. Exactly. So the idea is in helium-3 by magnetic field. In helium-3, these are L vector. So there's a magnetic field. So the vortices are created by rotation, and you have to apply a magnetic field to quench the spin orbit energy. Over here, the vortices are created by magnetic field, and the quenching is also done by magnetic field. So in other words, the magnetic field required for half quantum vortices is higher than small values. And it has to be above the spin orbit coupling energy.
There is also spin orbit coupling in some separate.
Yes. So there is. There's evidence of spin orbit coupling. In fact, you know, there's evidence of everything similar in Strunz-Shahn Luthenert as in helium-3, except the two cases are charged and non-charged. These are the only two differences. And so the proposal of Saloma and Volovic exactly fits into this. The only difference is this is charged.
So helium-3 is this A1 phase, which is fully polarized.
Yes.
You get it by applying pressure on the field. And that, I would imagine, is completely equivalent to spinless fermions.
Exactly. If you could polarize completely. So A1 phase has unequal superposition of the superconducting order parameter. So you have to have delta up to be finite and delta down to be exactly zero. That's the extreme version of A1.
Okay.
Have Bonin
talked about which phase? A1 or A?
No, A.
They talked about
yes.
A.
So this is also A. This is also A. In Strunz-Shahn Luthenert, this is A.
Uh-huh.
But still, so A1, if you had A1, then even ordinary vortices are non-abelian vortices. So that's very good, you know, which is what you can see or you can in principle have in optical traps, because there the spins are polarized, right? Which is what you guys worked on. But here it is really A, because upspin and downspin concentrations are equal. So that's the reason why the vortices are not Majorana vortices. But still, there are separate kind of vortices which are topologically allowed, but they are just not seen by a small magnetic field because of spin-orbit coupling. And you have to apply a magnetic field above the spin-orbit coupling value, which will then, you know, quench the spin-orbit coupling and make these half-quantum vortices lower in energy than ordinary vortices. That's the hope. That's this paper. Yes, so that was the method proposed to create a dilute gas of half-quantum vortices. Now notice the gas may not be dilute because there's a threshold magnetic field only above which these half-quantum vortices should be seen. So the gas may not be dilute, but the hope is, you know, it's small enough in the magnetic field. So the second experiment that he proposed concerns the 2D spinless PX plus IPY superfluidity in cold atom optical trap. Here the system is spinless is because it's spin polarized again, so spin is not an important quantum number. And here, so since the atoms are spin polarized, the phase back resonance, the dominant phase back resonance is P wave. It turns out if you have P wave phase back resonance, which has been seen, then you can have Px plus Ipy superfluidity, okay, at least from theoretical calculation, which is done by Victor and Leo and others. And then you have spinless Px plus Ipy superfluidity, where even the ordinary vortices are non-abelian vortices. We proposed Px plus Ipy superfluidity in optical traps, and you can create vortices. And in the case of atoms, you can actually solve another important problem in the context of TQC, which is the following, that if you have an ordinary electronic superconductor, if you have Majorana fermions, then you know Majorana fermions are spinless. It has to be spinless, otherwise gamma dagger will not be equal to gamma if you had up and down spins in the two electronic operators. They are spinless. At the same time, they are quasi-particles of a superconductor, they are chargeless, so there is no simple way to probe the Majorana particles. Okay? Here, there is, because atoms also have internal energy levels, so you can cleverly use internal energy levels of atoms by shining laser light, and depending on whether or not the laser light is absorbed, you can actually probe Majorana vortices or zero energy states, particles in zero energy states. And finally, we talked about STM signature or tunneling signature of Majorana fermions. This is what I was telling before. So you can have two Majorana, two vortices in a spinless P plus IP superconductor, or two half quantum vortices in a spin full P plus IP superconductor. And then the idea is if you inject an electron in one vortex, somehow the other vortex immediately knows about it. So even if this is far, far away, there should be an amplitude in the other vortex. And this is not ordinary quantum tunneling. This is like teleportation of the amplitude. Okay, but this teleportation, it turns out there's a finite energy scale, and also there's no information that can be sent in this process. So it does maintain causality. This would be a clear-cut signature of Majorana fermions in a P plus IP superconductor. So here is my summary and conclusion. So I've discussed 2D spinless P plus IP superconductor or superfluid which support Majorana fermions. I discussed BDG equations and index theorem. And then you can have non-local accommodation of a quasi-particle, which can give rise to a qubit. You have non-abelian statistics, which gives rise to unitary gates. I briefly talked about topological ground state degeneracy and talked about three experiments in one using half-quantum vortices in strontium-ruthenite, the second one cold atoms, and finally a teleportation type experiment using STM. Thank you.
Okay, actually, first let me just add one.